Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk on the Sundari Sutta and the liberation that comes from practicing restraint. This talk includes Sangha Q&A and discussion and was recorded at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on June the 7th, 2016. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Again, good evening, everyone. We have two new folks with us tonight. This is Maria and Joseph. Maria, is it okay if I explain why you're here, or would you want to? Maria is a doctor who's studying mindfulness and meditation and its benefits so that she can pass it on to her patients. So I think that's just wonderful. Yeah. and I'll give a very brief We talked a little bit. I'll give a very brief background into what we're doing here, and we'll do have a meditation, a lot more. Every class that I teach is about the same, and I usually teach to a specific topic that relates to meditation and mindfulness in the broader framework, and it's usually based almost, I think it's always based on a sutta, a teaching of the Buddha. So tonight is on the Sundari Sutta. Let me just read. I'll read the sutta. It's a short sutta. It's from a section of the Pali Canon called the Kadaka Nikaya, and Kadaka means short, or some will say to the point. And so it's a collection in the Pali Canon of very short teachings of the Buddha. Some of them are only a few lines long. The Dhammapada. Those of you that know what the Dhammapada is, that's part of the Kadaka. This is from a section called the Udana. Let me read it. The Sundari Sutta, or the Liberation of Restraint, teaches the unending peace gained through developing the Eightfold Path. This sutta is from the Udana, which is a collection of short suttas in the Kadaka Nikaya. In the Sundari Sutta, the Buddha shows that through restraint, developed through the Eightfold Path, any conflict can be resolved while maintaining a mind of peaceful equanimity. The Buddha was staying at Anathapindika's monastery, Jetta's Grove, near Savatthi. The Buddha's reputation and those of the monks had grown, and they were much revered. They were recipients of much generosity and were treated with honor and respect by the local community. There were a group of wanderers from another sect that were not revered or honored and did not receive much support from the community. Being unrefined and stuck in self-referential views, they were envious of the Buddha. By the way, that line is not in the Kadaka. I put that in. They were envious of, to make the point, they were envious of the Buddha and the Buddha's Sangha. One of their group was a young woman, Sundari. This unrefined group went to her and asked if she would do something to benefit their group. Sundari replied, "I would do anything, even give up my life, to benefit all of you." She should have been careful what she said. "Well, Sundari, we would like you to travel often to Jetta's Grove and make it appear to the townsfolk you are staying with some of the monks." Sundari agreed. Once it became well known that Sundari was apparently visiting the monks of the Buddha Sangha, she was murdered by members of her group and left by the side of the road. This group, suffering self-inflicted confusion and delusion, then went to King Pasanadi Kosala, feigning ignorance and concern. "The female wanderer Sundari has vanished. We cannot find her anywhere. We think she may have gone to Jetta's Grove." King Pasanadi instructed them to go to Jetta's Grove and look for Sundari. They retrieved Sundari's body and mounted it on a litter to display to the townsfolk. From street to street, they carried the decomposing body, shouting to all that could hear, "Look what the shameless followers of the Sakyan son," meaning the Buddha, "have done. Though they claim to follow a true Dhamma, they are evil and murderous liars." This is a pretty dramatic story to be in the Pali Canon, but it's not the only one. When the monks of the Buddha Sangha returned to town on their alms round, they were reviled, insulted, and harassed. Returning to the Buddha, they recounted their experience. The Buddha reminded them of the Dhamma and then tells them to remain calm, as this difficulty will not last long. After a week's time, this will pass. When you find yourself treated unfairly, remind those, and these are the quotes of the Buddha, "they suffer greatly who continue ignorance and lies as much as the instigator. Both are the same and will suffer the same fate of long-term confusion and suffering." In other words, continuing a lie, even if it's inadvertent, you are going to suffer that same fate until you realize that it's a lie, until you change your point of view. For the next week, the monks repeated this phrase when confronted by the misinformed townsfolk. Eventually, the reaction and disturbance in the minds of the townsfolk subsided, and they realized that the monks of the Buddha Sangha were innocent of any wrongdoing. The townsfolk understood that they had been taken in by those protecting the false Dhamma. After a week, the conflict ended, and the monk said to the Buddha, "It is amazing, astounding. Having practiced restraint and speaking only the truth, the conflict is over." In other words, they didn't get into a situation where they're defending themselves, getting it, well, this couldn't have possibly happened, we're not like that. They just laid out the truth for the folks, and eventually they came to their own understanding. One of the things that the Buddha is teaching here is that restraint of the need to defend the self-referential ego personality. I didn't do anything wrong. This is wrong. That just further entrenches that point of view, doesn't it? He simply instructed them to go into the town folk when they were harassed in a certain way to say, "You're mistaken." Period, basically. No need to defend yourself, because every time you defend yourself, you're entrenching that self-referential ego self. And I'll get into this a little bit more. The reason why the Eightfold Path is so effective is because we know if we're living our lives within the framework of the Eightfold Path, that we are remaining harmless. There's nothing left to defend. And we'll see very clearly how these things arise in other people's minds. We'll understand other people's confusion because we've now understood our own. Is that clear? Okay. A life of these, that's the end of the sutta. No, it's not. The Buddha responds, "Those unrestrained with no knowledge of the truth sling arrows at others like one at war. Those who have developed restraint through the Eightfold Path know to dismiss this foolishness and maintain a calm and peaceful mind." So no matter what's occurring in the outside world, no matter what other people might be attempting to put on us, we remain calm and at peace. We don't create any more stress in our lives. And how do we do that? Because we know that we've remained harmless. We've developed that refined mindfulness that lives within the framework of the Eightfold Path. So no matter what other people are saying to us, we don't react. I think many of us will understand at least how we tend to react at times when people put things on us that aren't our own, but we'll take it on because it's another person's point of view. We'll start seeing people through their eyes rather than our own eyes. And that's even a more discursive way of looking at ourselves in the world, isn't it? Because we're going from a misunderstanding through our own eyes through another person's eyes and taking that on as our own view of ourselves when none of it is true. But when we're living our lives from the point of view of a self-referential ego self, we're open to that type of clinging, aren't we? We attach ourselves to just about anything that happens. Somebody calls us a chair and we bend over and let them sit on us. You know? And we do it all the time. That might have been a poor metaphor, but people call us things, anything, and we take it on as the truth. Or at least we react in a way. Things happen in the world that have nothing to do with us, and we react to it in a certain way based on hardened views. The right political candidate might not be going where we hope they go. You know? We take that on. It causes stress in our lives. All of these things, again, it's kind of a silly example, but it's all part of taking on views that have nothing to do with us. A life of integrity, a life lived within the integrity developed through the Eightfold Path, diminishes conflict when conflict arises. Living within the framework of the Eightfold Path provides the assurance that one's actions are harmless to others and ourselves. The Sundari Sutta also teaches the comfort and safety that develops from taking true refuge in the Dhamma. Meaning, again, as we develop the Eightfold Path, we know that we're safe and secure in our own actions, in the words that come out of our mouth, because we've learned that refined mindfulness. I think every one of us has experienced that, haven't we? As we develop that refined mindfulness of right speech, we realize in the past where our speech might have been hurtful towards others, and we no longer do it, right? At least we're more mindful of it. And that's really the point. We have to have that initial mindfulness to understand what things we need to change, what things are arising from this self-referential ego personality. And again, that's the reason why the Buddha gave us an Eightfold Path, so that we had a framework to see where our actions are coming from. The Buddha describes a profound right view of an awakened, fully mature human being as understanding with regard to suffering. This is up here too. Understanding with regard to suffering, understanding with regard to the cause of suffering, understanding with regard to the cessation of suffering, and understanding with regard to the path developing the cessation of suffering. That's from the Digha Nikaya. An understanding in this sense means having fully developed these understandings, profoundly penetrating the truth of stress and suffering, developing and eliminating craving and clinging, having the experience of the cessation of this, even if it's just for a moment. The Buddha is not referring to ultimate right view. He's just pointing the way. And we all have had this experience, I think, even if it's just momentarily, of having that release from clinging, even if it's just on our cushions, but not having a reaction to life. And that gives us a reference point in that clouded place of a self-referential ego personality, doesn't it? We know what it feels like. We know what we use to get there. A well-concentrated mind within the framework of the Eightfold Path. And so then we know how to keep continuing to develop that experience. Is that clear? And I know you've just started meditating, so I'll exclude you unless this is true. Can everybody say that they've had an experience of release from clinging, even if it was only momentarily?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday.
Wow.
Yeah. I had a subcontractor who bid to do some work for me, and then on a given price, and then he went over the hours and was asking for this extra money, which had not been billed into the job. And so I was trying to explain to him, you know, the whole process, but he kept talking without putting a period at the end of any sentences and just kept going and kept going, and I said, may I speak? And he kept going, and he kept going. And I said, may I speak? May I have a turn? May I speak? And at one point, I shouted, like, may I speak now? And I heard myself, and I stopped. And I said, this is impermanent. You can't do this forever.
That's right.
And by the end of our conversation, he was actually offering to come and do a training session with my other employees, and we would have a picnic.
That's exactly how the Buddha got that monastery in Jetta's Grove, too. Initial argument with Anathapindika. Alan, thank you. That is a perfect example of the practical benefits of this. That's exactly how it should unfold. You know, instead of getting into defending yourself and yeah, but and all this stuff.
The way I picture it is, as soon as you do this, you've given them something to push against.
Yes.
And if you do this, they're going to run out of steam at some point. They have nothing
usually
to push against anymore.
Yeah. And even if they don't, then you just move away. But that is how it works. If you started to defend yourself, you're going to be in trouble. It relates exactly to the sutta, too. That's the kind of reference that we were talking about this on retreat, that when we work through and let go of all self-referential, ego-personality-based views, what's left? Everybody wants to know what's left. Well, what's left is still an ego, but the ego is simply then a function of the mind. It's not something that drives our behavior, drives every thought, word, and deed that we do. It's simply a reference point as to where we are in this continuum, in this ongoing process of becoming. And so I'm getting a little bit out of the context of tonight's teaching. But if you look at it that way, this is such a good example. In that situation, you could have reacted and defended yourself and continued confusion, deluded thinking, and more suffering for yourself and probably this other gentleman. Or you maintain the refined mindfulness that you've developed of the Eightfold Path. You maintain a mind of equanimity, and you continued becoming a more awakened, fully mature Helen. And that's a perfect example of it. And the nexus point where all of this revolved around, and this I'm really getting off topic tonight, is impermanence. The experience that Helen had of impermanence was just that nexus point of going one way or the other. And that depended on her skillful actions or lack of it. So does everybody see that? That's really why I asked the question. We've had that experience, even if it's just momentarily, of a lack of clinging. In our meditation practice, every time that we find that we're caught up in our thinking, acknowledge that and come back to the sensation of breathing, we're interrupting that process. We're interrupting that process of clinging one thought to the previous thought and to the next thought. We're interrupting the continuation of deluded thinking. That's what the reason why the, well, I can't see it from here anyway. That's the reason why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, to interrupt conditioned thinking or self-referential ego thoughts, one following another. And it's really the only reason he did it, but it's the most important reason to look at. We need something, we need a frame of reference in order to change our thinking from conditioned thinking, from continually reacting to life, to seeing life as a process of becoming based on, and will become based on what we hold in mind. Remember, mindfulness means to hold in mind or to recollect. If we hold in mind the principles of the Eightfold Path, we'll move towards full maturity and less stress and eventually no stress in our lives. Or we can ignore the process, dependent origination rooted in ignorance, leading to stress and suffering, and just continue that process. So let me continue a little bit more here. Developing the Eightfold Path brings a profound understanding of our own confusion, delusion, and suffering. Through this understanding, we gain understanding of others' confusion, delusion, and suffering. Through this direct knowledge, it becomes possible to practice restraint and remain disentangled from the events of the world and free of conflict. So you remember when this whole, when the story started with Sundari, the Buddha reminded them of the Dhamma. So he put them in their place to understand other people's confusion and what their motivation was, why this sect did such an awful thing. It was an awful, terrible thing to murder this woman and then do what they did with the body. But it was all rooted in deluded thinking. It was all rooted in a misunderstanding of who they are in relation to the world. They felt a strong need to do it based out of this confused state of mind. And so the monks could understand that, and that allowed them to not react. They could understand the confusion and suffering that this other sect was in and practice restraint. As we develop understanding of our own confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering, we can understand others then the same way. And that's true compassion. That's compassion married with true wisdom. That's why it works. That's why it's helpful to be that way. The Sundari Sutta shows the result of a well-developed Dhamma practice, the release from clinging and the resulting ongoing calm and peaceful quality of mind. It is through developing the Dhamma that it becomes possible to remain at peace with the people and events of life, including ourselves, as life occurs. So, that's the end of tonight's teaching. Any questions? Any other great stories like that one?
I have a story that's similar to Helen's that happened about a year and a half ago, and we were having a new roof put on at this building that we have, and luckily, I mean, we had a roofer who, it's an old building with the original roof, and so he had it tested for asbestos, and we knew that there was, you know, no friables, and it was like less than 2% of any kind of asbestos. So I knew that, and so the morning when they started, of course, they're there, and they're just heaving it off the building, and a friend of mine said on the Frenchtown Facebook page that someone had posted a post about, and I read it, and it was awful. It was like, beware, this asbestos roof is coming off, and stay indoors for several days. And it was like this fearful, you know, warning to everyone. And I thought, oh, this is not true. This is not wrong. I mean, this is so wrong. So I just went on and I said, you know, well, I am the owner of the building. And I just gave the facts. And I just said, you know, the shingles, the roof has been tested. It's not true. You know, there's no problem. I told all just all the facts and said, you know, we are good neighbors. And, you know, that's it. I didn't yell at her. I didn't even reference her. I just stated all the facts about what was really true and going on. And what happened was she ended up removing the whole post and within minutes. And then private messaging me saying, like explaining that she had cancer in her family and, you know, that she didn't mean to, and I just said, I'm really sorry for, you know, the illness in your family. And so, and now, I mean, it could have gone really badly between us, and I see her all the time in town, and it could have been continued stress every time, you know, I see, but it didn't. It just, you know, it was done. It was over, and we're friendly, and so, I think that's an example.
Oh, yeah. And you can understand her reaction based on what happened in her life.
I totally understand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing it clearly without reaction. And just a practical application of the Dhamma. And it relates, as in most of the teachings of the Buddha, it relates in very deep and meaningful ways to being mindful of the Dhamma and authentic to the Dhamma too. So this was another sect that had, or another so-called spiritual sect. They had their own beliefs. It's just that a lot of people weren't buying it at the time. But they were so enamored with being acknowledged as having some great spiritual teaching that they were willing to commit murder to achieve that goal, to get other people to believe what they believed. That's how far, not that anybody in this room would do that, but that's how far a self-referential ego self can take us in that confused, deluded way. And we feel that we're right. They felt that they were, as awful as their actions were, there was something inside them that said that it was okay to do this, to act this way. And we can do that on very subtle levels, not such egregious levels, by trying to protect a view that doesn't fit within the Eightfold Path. Again, the reason why the Buddha gave us that, if it doesn't fit within that framework, it's something that we should abandon, not something we should continue. And that can relate to Dhamma practice itself, what we take on as Dhamma practice, what we teach. You know, I had to think about that myself very clearly 6 years ago when I started teaching. What am I going to teach? Well, I decided I'm going to teach only what I know that the Buddha taught, not something else. But that can also be in how we represent ourselves too, you know, to be authentic to the Eightfold Path. The more we can develop the integrity, living our lives within the integrity of the Eightfold Path, the more we free ourselves of having to judge ourselves. Am I doing this right? Am I engaging in a way of life that is harmless to others and to myself? Because if we develop the Eightfold Path, we know we are. That's the true meaning of taking refuge in the Dhamma, in the Buddha's teaching. Because once we talked a little bit about this on retreat, once we can develop that to a certain extent, then we know that we are, to use a word, we're safe in the world. We're not going to cause harm to other people. Where in the past, if our motivations are still somewhat driven by a self-referential ego personality, they may be. We may come to a situation where we have to call out that person on Facebook rather than just speak the truth. We might have to engage in an argument with this worker rather than simply listen. Mm-hmm. All practical applications of the Dhamma. Moore, you had your hand up?
I was thinking because I read it a couple of days ago and I thought it was it's such a practical application because it's certainly it's something that I think we can all see all day long multiple times of just when are we reacting to something that we want more of or we've gotten something that we don't want and then we create a further tightening around ourselves, which usually doesn't feel so good. It feels restless if we're going after something or if we're trying to push it away. So I thought it was a great such a you mentioned it last week, I was kind of contemplating and reflecting on it because I think that it's like a wild, wild tale, really. You know, it's a gruesome tale, it's a wild tale, like who do you know that wouldn't say, I didn't rape that woman, you know, like, but, so, I just think it's kind of, obviously it's extreme, and I was reflecting, like, on the political situation, and of course, like, we're not just talking, just like last week when we were talking about going with the flow, just like, oh, not reacting, like, there's a very clear understanding of where behaviors come from another person. There's some type of clinging towards something that is wanted, you know, or trying to push something away. And if we don't get entangled, we can just see, like that sutta, just say, oh, that's just what it is. It doesn't hold the punch, you know, and it's such... Yeah, I had some small circumstances over the past couple days that was just like I wanted to make the situation different. And I just kept saying, like, just don't do anything. And it was fine. And eventually, because I had some stories and explanations about why things happened, and none of them were true. At all. And so, you know, I had I had the great opportunity to practice restraint and to really just maintain, like, just a loosening and space around my moment-to-moment, you know, unfoldings of my days, and, like, the thought would come back, like, I need to straighten that out. I'm like, just remember, like, you don't need to do anything. and then I got a really wonderful message this morning that was a completely, you know, I was like out in the field on this thing, but, you know. So, and I know, so I was thinking about it, like, can you imagine, of course, if our politician, you know, ever just really stuck to what was the matter at hand, the facts, and just did their job and didn't need to show how everybody else is wrong or they're right. Just so crazy. And it just becomes, you know, this, you know. I've had a couple of situations like over the past year where I felt like hurt, I felt accused of something that I didn't do. I've had lots that I've been accused of some, or not even been accused, and I reacted. So
preemptive.
Yeah, I know. Yes, preemptive strikes. You know, somebody says, "Oh, pick, you know, would you pick that up from the floor? Why are you saying I'm stupid and messy?" Yeah. So it's not like.
I remember that.
More than once. More than once, for sure. So yeah, you know, catching that inaction is it can be quite funny. And so I'm not saying that I am in any way skillful in this area, but kind of. Somehow, I think, you know, the more I meditate, the more space that is created, like, it's easier to see that unfold. And we talk about it all the time, but there's an energy that brings that into a more habitual pattern of the mind. So now, you know, instead of, like, you know, a couple times during my day today, like, I'm working with older people, and they're mad, and they're cranky, and they're telling me that I did something, and, like, I want to say, like, don't put that on me, and then I'm like, I don't need to say anything, just, you know, lift the foot, move forward, whatever it is, and it's just so, excuse me, it's so liberating to just be able to not take it personally, and to not further the tightening of ego, self, defensive, you know, I my whole life, I think, defensiveness is totally in my nature. And it's nice to have a few breaths without it. That's all.
Thank you. I should point out that Maura walked in a little bit late. Maura, this is Maria. She's a doctor who's watching what we're doing to gain an understanding. More as an OT, that's why she was referring to the patient. So in a broader sense, this sutta and the Buddha's words teach a conflict resolution, don't they? So it's not just something terrible, people accuse us of murder. This is applicable in any situation where conflict arises. And notice that the Buddha's not saying, he's not teaching passivity. He's not saying to just take it grimly. He's saying speak the truth, but remain calm.
Can I add one more thing? I'm sorry that this just, but I went into a new building later this afternoon, and there was a little bit of conflict between some, the staff members that I were with the staff members, a doctor and a nurse, and blah, blah, blah. And there was some misunderstanding. You know, somebody had their stuff on the wrong space. You know, so the other head of said, "Would you move that? Somebody's coming in," and then my gang were like, oh, you know, they're rude and it just was like, and that was the view going in there, that they're difficult. And I like from my perspective, your stuff is on a desk. It's totally natural. I continued, the whole discussion continued outside, and so, you know, anyway, my only point is I try to let go of all that all the time, and I had two more interactions with both, actually probably three, with these women, and it was completely normal. It was a completely normal interaction, very helpful and everything. So not trying to get hooked in, as you're saying, in other people's views that will contaminate how you see a situation. And I got the information that I wanted. I had good follow-through, signatures, everything good.
Good for you. So the other important point that the Buddha is making here, or understanding, is the understanding of impermanence. We can create a situation where it seems like nothing's changing by reacting to a situation. Moore is talking about this. Or we can have that profound understanding of a Buddha and know that everything's going to change. Most importantly, what people are holding in mind is going to change, as long as we don't do anything to reinforce it. Right? Impermanence is the key to everything, really. When the Buddha taught the three marks of existence, impermanence is the nexus point where we are in each and every moment. So the reason why I keep bringing this up is to reinforce the point that that as life occurs, each moment has the potential to incline our minds towards awakening, towards full maturity, and a life of lasting peace and happiness. Or we can disregard what we know, remain in ignorance, remember dependent origination, and continue confusion, delusion, and the ongoing unsatisfactory nature to life. That's the choice in each moment. That's the real importance of the refined mindfulness that's developed through the Eightfold Path, to understand that. Not to become fixed on it, not to make a kind of worship of the present moment, because remember, there's no such thing as the present moment. Everything is in a constant process of becoming. What are we going to become? And it's a pretty simple choice, isn't it? Do we want to become people that are living lives of peace and happiness? Or do we want to remain in conflict? In this tiny little sutta that first took place 2,600 years ago, speaks to that. And where does that conflict originate? It originates in our minds, not in outside occurrences. And so the solution to conflict is also in our minds. It's developed through the increased concentration that's developed through Shamatha Vipassana meditation that supports the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. Simply to see reality, see things clearly, understand the Four Noble Truths. Everything the Buddha taught for 45 years was in context of the Four Noble Truths, to see things clearly, to understand the interplay between a not-self characteristic, impermanence, and the resulting dukkha, or to become an awakened human being, shed that self-referential ego personality, and now simply have the ego as a function of our own, of a well-controlled mind that sees things clearly. And what happens? Then you live your life as a Buddha, as a fully awakened human being, not reacting to life anymore. Able to maintain that refined mindfulness moment by moment by moment. And the other, and I talked about refuge, the other important point about this is that idea of the true refuge in the Ratana Sutta, that we take refuge in the idea, in the understanding that a human being did this. It's not something that takes superhuman abilities. And he showed us exactly how he did it. We take refuge in that. And then, most importantly, we have we're so fortunate to have a sangha that is well focused on this, on these teachings. What?
No, I just heard a crazy talk.
I thought you were laughing at me.
No, I heard a crazy talk about like again. I'm sorry. This is somewhat off topic, but we talked a lot about the clarity of the Dhamma here, and it was from another another. But it was a. I don't want to say here in this camp something that would alienate another camp, because that is in right speech. Those are the guidelines to not say.
Well, something. We are the right camp. Of course we are.
I'm going to talk
self-referential.
So it is in right speech, that's a guideline that we shouldn't say one thing to. And I always think about this in families, right, or co-workers, or in this situation. You don't say something to another party that you already know there might be some strife, because if it creates disharmony, it's not within the guidelines of right speech. Not there yet either, but it's a goal. So in this particular discussion, it was about the benefit of community, and it was so jumbled and confusing about why we practice, why the Buddha said the Sangha is not the whole of, not half. He said, how important is the Sangha? And he said, is it 50% important? He said, no, it's the whole of the spirit, the holy life. And I don't know why you said something about community, but it was just it's not funny. But it was so confusing without a clear guideline about why the Sangha is important. Why refuge? What does refuge really mean? It's very clear.
Yeah.
Not to make it up.
That's the importance of remembering that everything the Buddha taught was in context, including that saying about the importance of the Sangha. Previous to that, he would say, when we are together as a Sangha, we talk about the Dhamma. We don't talk about anything else. Even if it might be, you know, some wonderful teaching that this other person has developed, that's outside of the Dhamma. When we're together as a Sangha, we talk about the Buddha's teachings. Again, that's the cohesiveness of the Ratana Sutta, what he's taught there. When we start taking things out of context, then anything goes. And I've said this. You know that I spend a lot of time teaching what it's not, for a very good reason. When you read the Pali Canon, you realize the Buddha spent nearly as much time teaching what the Dhamma isn't as he taught what it is. Because there were always these influences that wanted to make accommodations to the teaching, to make it fit self-referential views. Constantly people were coming into the Buddha Sangha saying, you know, what about this and what about that? And this guy down the street says, you know, we should jump it on your head for 15 minutes is a really good thing to do. Why don't we do that? And the Buddha says, it's just not part of the Dhamma. I mean, again, I'm being silly. And Vajragoda is probably the best example of that. But numerous times people would come and say, or his monks would go out and start teaching the Dhamma, and they'd hear something from another teacher that seemed to make sense, and they'd bring it back to the Buddha and said, should we do this? And he'd say, well, it's not part of the Dhamma. You know, let's keep it this way, because this is what we need to break through that confirmation bias, that conditioned thinking, and awaken. That's all. You know, so it's not to create conflict with other people, but it is to protect the integrity of the Eightfold Path and the Buddha's teachings. And that's the important. Again, that's what this sutta also teaches. That it speaks to that too.
So. But you do need to constantly test it.
Yeah.
Because it's just so easy to get a little negative. Oh, well, that sounds really nice.
Yeah.
And not until you retest it. Okay, you know, does it follow? You know, what does it for? You know, and we can fit this in the Eightfold Path. And well, that doesn't fit.
Yeah.
Another one in the dustbin.
Probably the best example. There's two great examples today, and I'll just mention engaged Buddhism. Engaged Buddhism is a type of Buddhism that says that we should take up causes, but there's hardly ever any underlying understanding of the Eightfold Path. So awakening has been put aside to engage in Buddhism. The other is the misapplication of dependent origination, and it's unbelievable how completely contradictory teachings are presented that say that they're dependent origination and have nothing at all to do with that key teaching. But it's presented in a way to accommodate what would follow after that. You know, and that's just really probably the best example around today. From that one accommodation or misunderstanding, a lot of what has followed has been very confusing and very very misleading to people that would otherwise, and that's really the problem, that would otherwise have an interest in developing what the Buddha taught and stay confused. And I know that from personal experience. You hear me talk about that all the time. So again, we got a little bit off topic. Thank you, Maura. So any we're going to go around the room later, but any questions about this idea using the Dhamma as conflict resolution? Especially conflict resolution in our own minds.
I find it really helpful when I'm heading into a situation where there is already a conflict and I'm sent in to fix it. And I realize going in that my mind is going in its normal pattern of, well, if they do that, then I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do that. And
thicket of views.
Yeah, thicket of views. And when I have enough time and I can let that stuff just run its course and just be done with that, then I can go in and deal with the people from the standpoint of, I don't really have an opinion here. Mm-hmm. Tell me what's going on.
Yeah.
And the conflict goes away.
Yeah.
It's because my point of view is not in there.
Yeah.
And it works like nothing else.
You're not feeding it anymore. The Buddha was often called to resolve conflict between governing bodies. You know, there was just as much conflict in the Buddha's time as there was then. And invariably what he would do was introduce the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path and encourage the parties to engage in right speech or recognize wrong speech, wrong action, and wrong livelihood. When King Ashoka came, this speaks to this, when King Ashoka was in power in northern India about 250, 300 years after the Buddha died. And he was one of the most bloodthirsty leaders the world has ever seen. All over northern India at the time, there were heads on pikes. That's where the name came from. He would murder people, and to prove how powerful he was, he'd stick their heads on pikes all over the country. He came across the Buddha's teaching, developed the Eightfold Path, gained full awakening, full maturity as a human being, and never harmed another soul again. How did that happen? Because the conflict in his own mind ended, and he no longer carried that out into the world. It is probably because of King Ashoka that much of the Buddhist teachings is still around today. There's still rock edicts all over northern India that King Ashoka had inscribed with the Buddhist teaching. It's still there. He ended any type of violence towards other human beings, but he also took it even further. There was still a lot of animal sacrifice at that time. He ended all animal sacrifice. He started free health care. This is 2,600 years ago, for everyone. And then he took that a step further and started free veterinarian care for all animals. Going from that insane state of mind, always in conflict, developing the Dhamma, and never harming another soul. And there's so many stories of like that in the Pali Canon. So it works. So if we want to develop a mind free of conflict, develop the Eightfold Path. It's a direct path. All right, let's meditate, and then we'll go around the room before it gets... So I'd like to hear how your meditation practice is going, and if any conflict arose in your most recent meditation, and any questions you might have about tonight's talk or about your Dhamma practice. And I'd like to start with Maria. Maria, welcome to our Sangha. How was your meditation?
It was really, really hard to keep coming back and trying to get myself away from those thoughts.
Yeah.
It's just, I feel like it probably takes a lot of practice and discipline.
It does. And it takes, over time, developing the broader framework of the Eightfold Path to support it. 20 minutes is a long time to meditate for someone just starting out. So you'll read in the book. I recommend that if you're going to establish a practice, start with 2 or 3 or 4 minutes. That's plenty. And if you can do that twice a day, consistency is much more important than length of time, especially in the beginning. So I'm glad you're here tonight. And I hope you learned something useful.
Yes.
Joseph, how about you? Welcome to our Sangha.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. It was really nice. It's definitely something I want to keep learning about and keep pursuing. pursuing seems really helpful.
Yeah.
One question I have about what I learned tonight would be, I want to try to discover how I can not react, but also how I can get my voice out.
Yeah.
Because sometimes when I don't react, it builds up and boils over when I happen
yeah.
to finally react. So if I could just learn how to be, still be able to say the truth or what I feel is the truth, but in a way that isn't making the situation escalate, as you were saying.
Yeah. That's an outstanding question. So you want to be a fully awake and fully mature human being, is that right? That's what we're all after. So the answer, I don't mean to be flippant or silly about it. The answer really is developing a well-concentrated mind within this broader framework, because eventually you get to the point where you do not react, and you see things clearly, you see things holistically as they're presenting themselves within the proper framework. So when the Buddha taught Four Noble Truths, he didn't teach anything magical or mystical. He taught them as a way of seeing life clearly as it occurs. So when you can fully develop that, and by the way, it doesn't take lifetimes and lifetimes. It may not even take, it takes some people, it takes them a week or two. Kandana, it took him one good lesson from the Buddha and he awakened. The point of that is to apply the teachings as best you can. If you can be part of our Sangha, it's so helpful. It's very difficult to do it by yourself. But start with short periods of meditation and slowly develop that broader framework. So the booklet will point you in the right direction. On my website, there's a recording of Shamatha Vipassana meditation and also with some metta meditations that are helpful. There's years of articles and talks. I would suggest start with the page that says for new visitors, because that's what it's for.
Mm-hmm.
But be part of a Sangha. And feel free to ask me any questions. Send me an email or give me a phone call. Maria has my number. So, and welcome.
Thanks.
It's nice to have you here. Ram, how about you?
Mm-hmm.
Great. I'm glad you're here. Judy, good to see you.
You too, John. Well, kind of the same for me. I feel like I'm on a roll. It's going very well.
Yeah.
Sitting much more regularly and twice a day most of the time. So that's good.
I guess it's for both of you too, and anybody else who wants to, that was on retreat. Do you feel like the retreat mind is carrying over? It's providing some support to your ongoing practice?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a steadiness there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Good. Helen, it's good to see you.
Thank you, John. It's good to be here. I have finally found the time to set aside in the morning. I was always trying to set it aside after my shower, and by then my mind was already on to everything else. So I just switched it up and started before my shower. I can sit for 20 minutes. It's just like, whoa.
It's amazing how quickly we get distracted, though.
Yeah, and I was thinking the other day that when your mind gets really distracted when you're trying to meditate, and I was cracking myself up because it's like your brain is like a radio, picking up radio signals. You know, like when you get a song in your head and you're like, I don't even like that song. Where did that come from? You know, it's like there's these radio signals out there and your antenna suddenly beep, 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 picks up on it. And so sometimes, you know, my meditation can be like that. So I've been accepting of how it goes. I'm not like, you know, oh, there's that song again, you know. I'm just let it roll. I'm just letting it roll and not putting any great expectations on it, and I'm getting much better results.
Isn't that amazing? So that's so important, Helen, that whatever our meditation session happens to be like, that's how it's like. It's not supposed to be any different. As long as we remember to come back to the sensation of breathing, the thought, that song comes back in our head, come back to the sensation of breathing, we're deepening concentration. That's the point of meditation. So thank you for bringing that up tonight. I'm glad it's working so well, too. Yeah. Mary Beth, good to see you.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, sometimes I'm sort of in a mode of like going through the motions more than I feel like I'm really having a solid amount of time. Although I'm making it happen. My practice is, you know, my routine is like before I go to sleep at night, I think. But you know, doing the occasional morning, which is progress for me. I feel like not to feel like it, but just make it a priority, even if it's for 3 to 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But I would like to get back to more of a true meditation. Maybe sometime now, I'm just not even doing it.
Yeah. That's great, Mary Beth. Yeah. Sometimes it does feel like we're just going through the motions. Nothing's really happening, but I think a lot of times that's the most important time. Well, at least what you're doing is you're deconditioning that conditioned mind's response to not wanting to do it. You know?
And just keeping it in the habit.
Yeah. Good for you. I'm glad you made it tonight. Maura?
There we go now. I think I was just thinking when I was walking up from the bathroom, again, just this is just a beautiful way to live.
Yeah, it's not bad.
I thought in tonight's meditation, not that, you know, again, it's still an impermanent thing, but I had an experience of just like experiencing the body as this field of sensation, and it was I feel like kind of overwhelming sometimes because there's a lot going on there, and just feeling that fear like comes up. Like just a felt sense of like that losing losing where kind of a reference point in that, like,
yeah,
it's beautiful and scary,
yeah,
or interesting and scary. It's not that we're not. It's interesting, it's moving and scary.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. That can knock you off your cushion if you don't have the right perspective. That fear, it's common that comes up. When you start letting go of these self-referential views, it feels like you're losing control. You're letting go of everything. And it's important to remember. That's why the framework of the Eightfold Path is there.
It's that funny thing where I've heard it also said, like, you want to sneak up on it like you'd sneak up on a cat. Like, almost... I'm always, well, anyway, I try to come let that peace not be so, it's so slippery.
That's a good word. And in the end, all that you can do is to recognize that it's an impermanent mind state, it's an impermanent quality of mind. It's rooted in a self-referential ego personality, and come back to the sensation of breathing. And eventually, the impermanence will persevere, and there it goes. You know, it's gone. But it does come up. It comes up often. That fear, that it feels like annihilation. But it's all, if you think about what is it that's being annihilated? It's that which causes confusion, delusion, and suffering. It's nothing. It's nothing of any substance. Again, that's what when the Buddha taught anatta, he taught not a self, not non-self, not that there's nothing. He just taught that what you think of yourself is not a self. It's a wrong view. Let go of the view. And then you can see clearly what's occurring. You know, what I often say about that is you can't know what you don't know till you let go of what you do know. You can't know what you really are when you're holding on to false views of what you think you are, because then you can't see it. And even that... the maintenance of those, you know, that ninth step is clinging and maintaining. That means maintaining that view. So even though you can maintain a continuity, continuity is only obscuring impermanence. It doesn't obviate it. It's still there. You know, it's still underlying. So. Thank you, Maury. Sue, welcome. I think this is your first time here, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Welcome to our sangha.
Thank
you. Sue came from Arizona to be with us tonight.
Are you from Arizona?
No. Oh, I said Sue. That's Sue.
I know, but for a minute I thought I was going to say, oh, you're from Arizona.
Welcome, Sue. I'm sorry to be so.
It's all new to me. I have slightly meditated, shall we say.
Uh-huh.
Liz has talked to me and explained a few things, but this was kind of overwhelming.
Yeah, it's a lot.
The first time. Yeah. I didn't think I could actually sit still that long because I'm a very antsy person, but I actually fell asleep. And that was a good thing.
Yeah, you didn't have to endure the whole 20 minutes.
She took the be at peace with yourself very, very seriously.
Good for you.
I was at a retreat actually with Liz in Arizona, and we were meditating, and that instructor said, when you get a thought, think of it as a leaf and throw it into the stream and let it just go away. So I tried some of that, and like I said, I fell asleep, so it was very, very relaxing and peaceful.
Yeah. I'm so glad you joined us tonight, and like I said to Marie and Joseph, if you're going to start a practice, start with short periods of meditation, and then develop the broader framework. Well, you'll be here on Saturday too with the
yes.
Yeah, so we'll do more of this, and you'll get a little bit more background in it too. So, right? I'm glad you're here tonight. Mary, how are you?
Very good, John.
Good to see you.
Good to be here. Good to see you. This is my first visit since our retreat.
Oh, that's right.
So
yeah.
Thank you very much. It has stayed with me.
Great.
And, you know, although my kids haven't said anything, I can tell they're kind of going, like, Mom seems a lot calm.
Let's not say
it. Let's not
start off. Right. So, I'm sure my husband's thinking that too. But I think for me, when you experience a shift, whether it's small or large, or you experience some awareness, for me, there's no going back.
Yeah.
So, you know, I know we're never the same person, but I'm not the same person I was when I came to the retreat.
Yeah.
Continue to evolve. So I'm very grateful for the retreat. It was just really life-changing. I appreciate everything that you and Maura and everybody did to pull that together. I think everybody felt that way.
Yeah.
So
me too.
Really great. And I have to ask, who did those? Did this come out as a result of?
Yes, that's from the retreat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
John, you can print them out here.
Yeah, they're on the website.
Well, we talked about it at the retreat.
Yeah. I wish I had blown them up bigger. I thought that'd be big enough to be useful.
No,
but
it's not from here. It's
yeah.
Even with my gloves.
So one of these days I'll blow them up. But yeah, that's.
Well, my practice is going well. This is all really coming together for me.
Yeah.
How this all integrates. It's very good.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your kind words. And that really is, you know, both of those together really do show how the Dhamma works.
Did Jen do it?
Pardon me?
Did Jen do it? Or
John did it?
No, I did.
Oh, you did it.
Yeah, I did
it.
Yeah.
And then Staples helped.
Yeah, Staples blew it up, and
nice
Michael's had the frames on sale, so it all worked out.
Yes, wonderful.
Thank you. Liz, it's good to see you. How are you?
Practice is going well. I was thinking as Maura was talking, there was actually a point when I was totally in the groove with meditating where I actually got to the point where thoughts had seriously dissipated and there was a great deal of space. And I got concerned.
Yeah.
I got concerned.
Well,
I was like,
yeah.
I thought, I'm getting dementia. I really lost my mind now.
But it was a pleasant type of dementia.
Well, I got afraid. That threw me off. But
yeah.
Anyway, the other thing is that I've been listening to the
tapings of the retreat on very, very long walks on the trail with my headset and my phone. The Fire Sutta.
Yeah, the Fire Discourse, yeah.
Amazing. The Billy Joel song, We Didn't Start the Fire, keeps coming up in my head when I think about it. And when I'm in an inflamed situation, to be able to say, don't feed the fire, don't feed the fire. And that's been really, really helpful. So things, you know, and it's funny how, I don't remember your name, I'm sorry.
My name?
Yes, your name.
Joseph.
Okay. Joseph, you know, you want to know how to not overreact to things. And the thing that John always tells us is you have to be gentle with yourself because you could do this for, you know, 2.5-3 years, which is where I am, I guess. Maybe it's less than that. But, and then you can still have a moment where you're going to have an outburst. And then you just kind of go back and you start all over again and you start from where you are and you forgive yourself for that and get back into it. And it's just, we're human. So I just wanted to say that to you.
And it's the opposite of being passive, because once all this stuff starts to...
That's another thing. It takes
I mean, I am much more vocal. That's more authentic. As my practice is deeply, I have a much more honest voice. I used to have a big mouth. Now I have a more honest voice.
So that's
my delusional.
No, that's true. That was right speech there, Maura. Passivity is avoided. When you develop the Eightfold Path, because you're taking right action, that's fourth factor of the Eightfold Path, 1, 2, 3, 4, right action. It just guides our actions. We know how to act. We know how to respond to life. And your actions are focused towards developing lasting peace and happiness rather than continuing confusion and delusion. You know, it's...
Yeah.
A word that's often used instead of right action is skillful action. So, and very quickly you realize the benefits of this way of living, and you learn that most important thing that I forgot to say tonight, probably the first night, is to be gentle with yourself. If you start judging yourself harshly, that you're not doing it quick enough or right enough or any of that, you're going to give it up. That's just human nature. You know, we can beat ourselves up so long before we stop. And that's a function of an ego personality. That's, you know,
Can I just say one
please.
Other thing? Sue had mentioned a meditation we were doing. It was at a center kind of thing that wasn't Buddhist related. But the thing that I find so much more effective is having heard what the process is here and the things that anchor you in your seat while you're meditating. It's a guided path towards something rather than a time of just sitting for relaxation. This is more than that.
Yeah.
And whenever I would meditate before, I would feel like, well, God, those profound things aren't happening. I must not be sitting up straight, or I must, I moved, or I, you know, whatever. And but with the information, I find it's just more effective and not enjoyable, but it's a feedback loop.
Yeah, it's more practical.
Yeah.
For years, I meditated hours and hours and hours, long sesshins, day after day after day. And I could never figure out. And I was told things, well, you got to move you got to have your back just a little bit like this and the toe like that. None of it really made any difference. And because I didn't have the framework to understand my own conditioned thinking, it was never presented to me. And I, you know, I'm fortunate now because of the position I'm in that I hear that the people that have the most difficulty developing the Buddha's teachings are the ones that have been practicing Buddhism the longest. And, you know, I'm included in that. And they have, and many of them have this, it's a typical response when they first take up the course. They're kind of proud to say, I've been meditating for, pick the year, 15, 20, 30 years, and I meditate every day for an hour. And they come to the course and they say, well, I don't even know what I'm doing anymore. What's going on here? Because they finally have a frame of reference rather than wandering around in their own minds. And that's what I found I was doing. I was just reinforcing views of what I thought I should be doing rather than actually looking at my own views. And that made all the difference in the world. And that's why the Buddha never taught just meditate. He always taught meditation within the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. And he taught it not as an insignificant part, but not, he never overemphasized meditation either. He never talked about, I've yet to come across anything where the Buddha says you should be meditating for 6 hours a day every day, anything like that. His references to meditation are usually referred to as relatively short periods, and basically it's go find a quiet place to sit and be mindful of your breath within this broader framework. And when you hear it, when you read the accounts of the Buddha's own meditation, he's not, it's not a description of the Buddha entered meditation and then 20 minutes later he had a thought. It describes his ongoing thought process while he's in meditation. So that's why I always say it's not about trying to find a trance-like state. It's to develop concentration and not be distracted by our own thoughts. And that's what you get when you read about how the Buddha meditated. He was able to gain insight into his thoughts because he wasn't distracted by them anymore. Thank you for bringing all of that up. Lisa, so good to see you again. Welcome to our Sangha.
My meditation practice has been continuing, only that I wasn't feeling very well for a while, so it really wasn't quite as robust as it had been.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't stop it. Mornings are very important for me. And I just got back from a 5-day conference, which really was all about an unconditioned self and an ego, not Buddhist. Not in there. It was just a spiritual conference I went to. But the one takeaway, a couple takeaways, it was focused only on joy, happiness, and love, which is your essential soul. And then the ego is the story that, I mean, it was almost like hearing you, only you had a British accent. But a lot of what I recognized at that point as I was sitting there, that I really get this, like, and I do play this in my life and spend my time there, and that, and then I'm reminded of the clinging, craving, and wanting something different. And for me, it's always wanting to be better at something, or thinking that I should be perfect, or I shouldn't have these issues, or I shouldn't have an outburst, or I, you know, if I'm doing this right, then you know I should be apparently floating on air, you know. Enlightened right away. So it was just, I think what I wanted to share here is that this has been so important in my life and has changed so much of my life to a point where I show up in it. And I show up in it in this really healthy way. I have these amazing relationships as a result. I've been able to do some things that I wasn't able to do before. I make decisions now that are just thoughtful based on who I am, by my authenticity. I'm the authentic self and not the ego and all those things and pride and all that. And it's just shifted everything. And this was the time I was supposed to return to the Sangha. So I'm thrilled to death that you're always here. And
thank you, yeah. I'm always here. Where else am I going to go?
Other than the weather, I don't think you've ever canceled.
No, only when I can't get down the hill. I think like 2 or 3 times.
Skiing, don't.
not on these legs.
Slalom.
It's just that way. You know, the Dhamma is for developing the refined mindfulness that allows us to be very, very effective human beings because we're here. Because we're here. We're not stuck in the past or the future. We're not reacting to life. We're fully present with life as life occurs. That's how it works. Yeah. Lorna, good to see you.
Good to be here, John. Thank you. Your talk this evening has
prompted me to realize what I am doing right and what I am not doing right. Let me explain. I think I've become more mindful of people, my interactions with people through following the Dharma practice. Certainly, sort of watching television, I've cut down an awful lot. Social media, all that sort of stuff, you know. I'm very mindful of what that, just the whole distraction out of my life. But when I'm doing that, I'm not in my life. I'm very, very aware of that. And I've become mindful of those things. However, this weekend, a situation arose which absolutely threw me through the loop. I have two dogs, and one of them became ill. He was walking with a very hunchback and obviously in a lot of pain. You know, he'd squeak. And so, long story short, we took him to a vet. But all this, it happened at the weekend, so I couldn't get him to the vet straight away, so I had to wait, and that made him more anxious and things like that. Turns out he's got a disc problem, bulging disc in his back, so he's on medication now. He's a lot more settled. I'm a lot more settled because he's been treated. I know what the problem is. It's, you know, probably a few weeks, quiet life, and he'll be off and running again for that. So, however, the point of me talking about this is that I completely, the whole Dharma practice didn't sort of work for me in the situation of my dog. It kind of just like snuck under the radar. As I said, I'm sort of mindful of a lot of things in my life I've become mindful of. And I know there's a lot of craving clinging with your dog. Obviously that's a big thing. But I do feel so responsible for him. And because I feel so responsible, he's almost part of me. And the whole situation, just, I mean, my mind just like, it was like I'd never been here for a couple of days. I felt very unhappy again, felt very tense, felt all like I used to do. In fact, it was a good reminder of how I used to live. Yeah. It was that bad, it was like I used to live. But anyway, and I meditated throughout everything, but the short meditation. So I played that and then went into my meditation. So that sort of drifted me into my meditation. So I kept meditating and everything. I was sort of, but as I say, the whole, because it's my little dog, you know, I just lost my composure. Didn't see through things, didn't think about impermanence, or so. I don't know if you can give me any advice of, you know,
yes.
what actually I was missing in the Dharma, that I was there that I wasn't seeing, so that in the future, like we've talked about social media and conversations and not getting into arguments, and which have been very helpful, and I think I'm sort of observing them. But the whole little dog thing
was
just threw me
in
a loop. I don't know if you can
give
me any
explanation. Yeah, I can. Be gentle with yourself and continue with your practice.
I did those.
And that's all we can do. When something like that happens, it's just human nature to kind of lose the perspective of right view and just become involved in what's occurring. So this, you know, you didn't do anything wrong. You know, it's not like you disavowed the Dhamma. You just got caught up in life. So remember, the Buddha...
That's what happened.
Yeah.
So how do I not...
Oh, with continued practice, that's all. You know yourself, Lorna's been coming about 14, 15 months to class. And she's made just, not to get into the whole story, just really remarkable progress. So that you got a little bit more to go. That should, really, what is best to acknowledge is how much and how well you've developed the Dhamma, that it only threw you for a couple day loop,
yeah.
rather than leading into something else that was just ongoing.
Yeah,
and that's
wisdom.
The important thing to recognize. Is
yeah, it's about wisdom. It's about understanding that these things aren't going to go away, but we have wisdom around them. You know, we're not, we can't, the life is going to keep happening, but we're not going to get stuck in it forever. So it's more like, what are you learning, rather than what did you do or not do?
I think what I've learned is that I look for the Dhamma in a lot of ways in life, but all mainly through people and interactions through people.
Yeah, that's where those virtuous factors come into play, because it's in our interactions with other people or with our favorite pets that we get to see our craving and clinging. That's why they're there. And initially it led to an agitated mind state for a couple of days, but you were able to come back because you have that frame of reference to understand what was occurring. And in a practical way, you minimized the amount of stress that was there in the situation. It wasn't ongoing. You were able to come back to your Dhamma practice, which is what it was there. Another way of saying that is you were able to regain your mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
So the Dhamma is not about, and I know this is not what you're talking about, but it's not an escape from life. It's not a way of developing one way of feeling, which is whatever we decide peace might be. It's to be able to be fully involved with life as life occurs without needing it to be any different than it is. So when our dog comes up lame, we're able to respond rather than react. When something else occurs, we're able to we keep our mindfulness. We see things in the perspective of the Eightfold Path. The best story about this is when the Buddha heard that his dad was dying, he didn't say, I'm going to go meditate. I don't need to deal with this. He got his alms bowl and he put his robes on and he walked 140 miles to be with his dad before he died because he wanted to be. The Eightfold Path is a path that avoids extremes of behavior, including extremes of views, as of, I don't feel anything. This shouldn't be occurring in my life. It allows us to be fully involved with our life as life occurs, and especially when our pet needs us. So I was an appropriate response.
Know what it feels like, rather than saying, well, it's internal, which is a view. You know, this is what it feels like when we love so much. And suffering.
And it's
too. That's dukkha dukkha. That's like the dukkha dukkha. The dukkha has all kinds of... But I mean, dukkha has all kinds of suffering. And if there's the dukkha of change, the dukkha of, you know, aging, death, and all. So, like... to me, all I hear is somebody who is able to really take care of something that she values.
And thank you for bringing it up.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for
coming. Bonnie, how are you tonight? Good to see you.
Good. Thank you. It's good to be here. It's sort of like I'm coming to... get to another level a while ago where you talked about when we learn something, talking about different visual ways of seeing something. You had talked about it's like being inside, walking inside of a Nautilus, remember?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember saying that to me, but that, so while we're learning, we're like walking inside of this Nautilus and integrating the kind of stuff that we've learned. I used to say it was like a spiral stair. We get to a certain place, and I hit my head, and I'm like, oh my God, I thought I dealt with this stuff already. But
mm-hmm.
you're on a different level.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of walking up in a Nautilus is sort of, I love that idea visually, but for all kinds of reasons. So I feel like I just, you know, I get to a certain point, I think I'm starting all over, but I'm not. I'm looking over another wall or another
mm-hmm.
place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so... looking at, like, you know, right view, it's almost like
mm-hmm.
starting over again and trying to work on, I guess it has to do with boundaries and what I'm responsible for in my
yeah.
work. What, because sometimes I feel like I'm more responsible, or I can't not be not responsible, but what am I responsible for in the work and what are other people responsible
mm-hmm.
for? Because otherwise it gets scary for, you know, be constant. But in doing that, then, it helps me, like, you know, what everybody's saying, all the different parts are, like, you know, so integrated in a way for me about, you know, trying to decide what I need, what's right, to be able to make decisions about life. But yet, you know, I still, like, you know, it's like walking in that Nautilus, you come around, okay, or there's, I think it's like being on a merry-go-round and seeing the same things on a but to slow it down. And, mm-hmm. and so, you know, it's not easy sometimes, it's hard. So that's a good thing, because when I get the clarity, then I can be like, see, now you can remember this. The next time that happens, you don't have to do that, you know, the heart, you know, being hard on myself, or the critical nature. So it's good.
Yeah, that's so important. Yeah, to not be hard on yourself. Another way of looking at that is the word that's often used in the Pali Canon is samsara, meaning this life that we're living. Samsara means like an illusory state that's prone to the disappointment of the First Noble Truth. And so until we are able to see this process clearly, we're wandering endlessly in this place called samsara. But notice that the Buddha never said this existence is an illusion. He said it's like an illusion, and that's a significant difference. Because we're caught up in seeing things from wrong view, we're not seeing reality. What we're seeing is like an illusion. It's obscuring the true nature of understanding the Four Noble Truths. Another way of talking about taking on too much as our role. There's a story called The Handful of Leaves. It's a great story. So the Buddha was walking through the forest with a bunch of monks, and they were talking about what they would normally talk about. And the Buddha wanted to teach them, because they're starting to get into these esoteric questions about infinity and eternity and all that. And the question was put to the Buddha, you know, what do you know about this? And the Buddha reached down and picked up a handful of leaves, and he says, what do you think my knowledge is like? Is it like the leaves that I have in my hand, or the leaves that are in the canopy of trees? And the monk says, well, your knowledge is like all the leaves in the trees. And he says, that's right, but I only teach what I have in my hand. I only teach what is most useful to you. I teach the arising of suffering and the cessation of suffering, nothing more. And he consistently said that throughout his life. So and that's such a good example to what we do in our own lives and our own jobs. Do we take on too much, or do we just deal with what we can handle? You know, the handful of leaves.
Well, I think even in this moment now, what I keep coming back to is, if I let go right now of a view that I didn't do that right, or I should have done it differently, what's left? There's no difference right now. That's all we can do.
Yeah. So, another great class. Again, to place the importance on the Eightfold Path and developing an understanding of anicca, anatta, and dukkha. Just a quick announcement, and then I'm going to finish with the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This Saturday is mindfulness-based stress reduction. Mindfulness-based recovery workshop right here in this room. There's info on the website. The next workshop will be a 12-step workshop here on June 16th, and then July 30th will be an MBR workshop at Hunterdon Integrative Medicine at the building where I teach in Flemington. I think that's all for the announcement. So let's. Oh yeah, thank you. I'll be starting to teach at Phillips Barber on Thursday nights at 7:30. So there's info on the website there too. So I'll read the Buddha's words on metta rather than my own. So metta means goodwill or loving kindness, and we first express that goodwill to ourselves and then to all. Oh, this is a different one. The Karaniya Metta Sutta is the Buddha's words on metta. And so metta is both an aspiration for those of us on the Eightfold Path, and it's an expression of a fully awake and fully mature human being. The Karaniya Metta Sutta shows that the most loving and compassionate action that anyone can take is to engage wholeheartedly with the direct teachings of the Buddha and awaken. So gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth again. And just take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that might have arisen from our talk tonight. And these are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful Dhamma class. Peace. Thank you. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.